You know, we often talk about the really big health issues like heart disease or cancer. Mm. But I saw something recently that kind of stopped me in my tracks. In Canada, hospitalizations just from alcohol use hit like 77,000 in 1 year.
Wow.
Yeah. And get this. That's actually a little higher than the number for heart attacks, which was around 75,000. Makes you think, doesn't it? About something so, well, common.
It really does. And those numbers, they just paint such a stark picture, you know? How everyday behaviors really impact our health. It sort of challenges what we assume are the biggest threats. Things that are socially okay, even legal, can have these huge consequences.
Okay, so let's really dig into this. Today on The Deep Dive, we're focusing squarely on health-compromising behaviors based on some really interesting lecture material. We're going to unpack what defines these behaviors, get into the weeds on substance dependence, and look at specific examples like alcohol use disorder, smoking, and eating disorders too.
And for you, the learner, the goal here is to get a really clear, concise handle on these complex issues. We want to give you those core insights, you know, the why behind these behaviors developing, why they stick around, and the impact they have. Think of it like a shortcut to understanding the key takeaways. We're talking about those aha moments, like why adolescence is such a key time, how our self-image plays a role, and even, yeah, the pleasure aspect.
Absolutely. So this lecture material we're drawing from, where did it start with breaking down these behaviors?
Well, first, it kind of set the terms, saying these are sometimes called risk behaviors or problem behaviors. Same idea. And even though they look different, you know, smoking versus an eating disorder, there are common threads, these characteristics that kept coming up.
Okay, like the first one that jumped out at me was this window of vulnerability. During adolescence, right, roughly 13 to 17. Why then?
Yeah, that's a really critical developmental stage. The lecture stressed that this is often when patterns around drinking, smoking, even eating habits, they first get established. Wow. It's a time of huge change, physical, social, figuring out who you are. And that can make teens, well, more open to experimenting with these things.
And then the self-presentation idea, how we want others to see us, that clicked for me. The lecture used smoking is a great example. You know how it went from being cool in old movies to, well, definitely not cool now.
Exactly. How society views these things changes massively, right? And that affects how common they are. What used to project one image, like sophistication, can become really stigmatized as we learn about the harms. And the lecture pointed out that changing behavior often involves tapping into that desire, wanting to present yourself differently, healthier.
Interesting, too, that the lecture actually acknowledged that these behaviors often provide some pleasure, at least initially. Feels a bit weird to say, but it's true, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a crucial part of the puzzle, that initial reward, that feeling, escape, satisfaction, whatever it is, even if it's short-lived, it can be a powerful hook, especially early on. The lecture also stressed that these things tend to develop gradually. It's usually not 0 to 60 overnight. They often escalate bit by bit, which really highlights why catching things early is so important.
Right. And it mentioned common predictive factors and a similar profile for substance abusers. Sounds like there are underlying things making some people more susceptible.
Yeah, it didn't dive super deep right then, but it set the stage, hinting that it's complex, you know, multiple factors involved. Some people might just be more predisposed or their circumstances might make them more vulnerable.
And finally, the socioeconomic drivers, linking lower socioeconomic status to more negative health behaviors. It's a tough one.
Well, the lecture framed it as potentially being about coping mechanisms. If you're facing more daily stress, more challenges, maybe these behaviors feel like a way to manage or just get some temporary relief. It's a complex link.
Okay. So then the lecture moved into defining substance dependence. It mentioned the DSM. What's the DSM for anyone listening?
Right. The DSM, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's basically the handbook mental health pros use for diagnoses. So the lecture explained, based on the older DSM-4, but still relevant to the DSM-5, that substance dependence is really about continuing to use something like drugs or alcohol, even when it's causing major problems, problems in your health, mental health, relationships, work, you name it.
What really stood out to me was that dependence isn't just about, you know, illegal drugs. The lecture said it could be food, porn, betting.
That's a really important point. The core issue is that compulsive behavior, that inability to stop despite negative consequences. It's not just what you're using. Then the lecture zeroed in on what it called the pillars of addiction, tolerance and withdrawal.
Tolerance that's needing more to get the same buzz, right? Like the example of needing more beer in university than when you first started drinking.
Exactly that. Your body adapts, so you need a higher dose for the same effect. And withdrawal is the flip side. Those really unpleasant physical and psychological symptoms you get when you cut back or stop using the substance.
Yeah, the story shared in the lecture about the heroin user just continuing to use to avoid withdrawal, not even to get high anymore, that was powerful. Really shows the grip it can have.
It's a really stark illustration of how strong physical dependence can become. So the American Psychiatric Association's definition wraps this all up. Tolerance, withdrawal, and that compulsive behavior, that drive to get and use the substance. Physical dependence is often right there too.
Okay, so we've got the behavior's dependence. Then the lecture switched gears a bit to something called harms reduction. What's the thinking behind that?
Harms reduction is, it's a really practical public health approach. Instead of only focusing on stopping the substance use completely, it aims to minimize the negative consequences that come with it. It acknowledges that, look, substance use happens and asks, how can we make it safer for the person using and for the community?
The lecture called it the Jedi mind trick. I like that. Focusing on the outcomes people worry about, like suicide risk with cocaine, not just saying, stop using cocaine.
Yeah, that shift can be really effective. People might be more motivated to change if you talk about risks to their safety or their job or relationships, things they care about right now. And the lecture also said it allows for more realistic goals. Small steps, achievable changes.
And it gave specific examples, like methadone clinics. How do they fit the harms reduction model?
Right. So methadone clinics provide a legal, medically supervised opioid methadone as an alternative to illicit ones like heroin. The idea is to reduce the really big risks linked to street drug use. Overdose, getting HIV or Hep C from shared needles, crime related to getting drug money. Methadone helps stabilize people's lives.
And then needle exchanges. I know those could be controversial for some people. What's the public health argument there?
They're a key strategy. The main goal is preventing the spread of blood-borne diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. They give people who inject drugs clean needles and syringes and a safe place to get rid of used ones. And the lecture used that example, you know, preventing little Timmy from accidentally picking up a used needle in the park. It highlights the broader community safety benefit, too.
And then the big one, safe injection sites. Insight in Vancouver was the main example. What did the lecture highlight about Insight?
Insight opened back in the early 2000s in Vancouver's downtown east side, which was hit hard by the overdose crisis. It basically provides a clean, supervised space where people can inject drugs they've already obtained with nurses right there. The video material emphasized it was a response to sky-high overdose deaths and HIV rates. And the data shows it's worked significantly reducing both. Crucially, it also highlighted that for many, it's not about getting high anymore. It's about managing withdrawal, about just trying to get unsick. And Insight connects people to healthcare, detox, treatment referrals, even housing or job resources, takes drug use off the streets, making things safer overall.
Okay, moving on. The lecture then got into illicit drug use. Pretty straightforward definition there.
Yeah, simply drugs that are against the law. The lecture mentioned the main classes: opiates, cocaine, cannabis or THC, and amphetamine-type stimulants.
But then it raised a flag about something maybe less obvious.
Yeah.
The misuse of prescription psychoactive drugs.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge problem now. The lecture specifically called out prescription opioids like OxyContin and stimulants. These are drugs people might get legitimately or find in the medicine cabinet at home, but then they're used in ways they weren't prescribed, fueling the opioid crisis.
And that rainbow party trend among teens? Honestly, that was shocking to hear about.
It's really disturbing. It shows a scary lack of education and vulnerability. Kids mixing whatever pills they find at home, having no idea about the dangerous interactions. It's a stark example.
So what are the main consequences the lecture outlined for illicit drug use?
Well, it covered a few areas. Physically, obviously, potential damage to organs, the brain included, and the risk of infectious diseases, especially with injection use. Mentally, things like increased anxiety or that rebound depression, you know, the crash after the drug wears off, like a really bad hangover, but often worse. And socially, impaired judgment leading to risky decisions, including unsafe sex.
Okay. Let's shift to alcohol use disorder, AUD. The lecture mentioned it was recognized as a disease way back in 1957 by the AMA.
Yeah, that was a big step, moving away from seeing it as just a moral failing. And the lecture really drove home the impact by talking about mortality, and those hospitalization numbers we started with, comparing them to heart attacks, really puts the scale of the problem in perspective.
And the specific health problems linked to it: high blood pressure, liver damage, cardiovascular disease, heart stuff, and then fetal alcohol syndrome and ARND. The lecture was clear. FAS is irreversible.
Exactly. Fetal alcohol syndrome causes permanent physical, cognitive, behavioral issues if a mother drinks during pregnancy. ARND, alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, is broader, maybe not full FAS criteria, but still significant learning and behavior challenges. And while FAS damage is permanent, the lecture did mention that with ARND, sometimes early support can help people compensate and manage better.
The lecture also broke down being physically addicted, withdrawal, tolerance, losing control versus being a problem drinker who has issues but maybe isn't physically dependent in the same way. Can you clarify that difference?
Sure. So someone physically addicted might get the shakes, seizures, really severe withdrawal if they stop suddenly. And they need more and more alcohol for the same effect tolerance. A problem drinker might, say, binge drink every weekend, causing fights with their partner, social issue, feeling awful and anxious the next day, psychological, maybe missing work, biological consequence. But they might not have those intense physical withdrawal symptoms if they skip a weekend. The line can be blurry, but there's a distinction. The lecture then looked at what causes or contributes to AUD.
Genetics definitely came up. A family history.
Yes, that predisposition is real. Also, sex differences, men historically higher rates, but the gap's closing. Lower socioeconomic status is a factor. Response to stress and trauma is huge. Social cues like, you know, being around environments where drinking is constant and cultural norms too. Think big sporting events.
And it specifically zoomed in on university students. High rates of unhealthy drinking, especially rising among women, seems like the environment plays a big role.
Definitely. The lecture highlighted that whole situation. First time away from home, social pressures, parties, maybe a campus culture where heavy drinking is just normal. The stats on binge drinking at campus events and how it differs if you live on or off campus really showed that. Oh, and it also briefly mentioned the rise in drinking during the pandemic as a coping strategy for stress and isolation. That's a recent concern too.
Okay, so when it comes to treating AUD, what influences success? Age. Support.
Yeah, the lecture mentioned that sometimes people mature out of heavy drinking patterns as they get older, change priorities. Socioeconomic status matters, having resources helps, and definitely access to care and having good social support, that's critical for recovery.
Common treatments mentioned were AA, CBT, detox.
Right. Alcoholics Anonymous is that peer support model. Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, CBT, helps change the thinking and behavior patterns around drinking. And detox is the managed withdrawal phase, often medically supervised to be safe. Relapse prevention and general prevention strategies were also stressed as important.
And finally, it asked, can alcohol be healthy? We hear mixed messages about that all the time.
Yeah, the lecture tried to summarize that. It mentioned some studies suggesting potential benefits in strict moderation, maybe for HDL good cholesterol, maybe the antioxidants in red wine, slight immune benefits, maybe lower stroke risk. But, and this is a huge but, it stressed moderation is key. The type of alcohol matters, and people react very differently. For most people, the risks, even with moderate drinking, likely outweigh any potential small benefits. Heavy drinking is always harmful, full stop.
Okay, let's switch it up. Cigarette smoking. The lecture started by mentioning that informal survey we did and how much smoking rates have actually dropped.
Yeah, that decline is a major public health success story, really. The lecture then walked through the history. Early 1900s, rates were pretty low.
And it sounded like Camel cigarettes and their marketing were a huge factor early on, especially with the FDA not really regulating tobacco initially.
Absolutely. That lack of oversight let companies go wild with advertising. The lecture even mentioned doctors endorsing smoking. Hard to imagine now. Then the Depression caused a dip. People just couldn't afford it. But then World War II.
Right, giving cigarettes out as rations to soldiers. That must have hooked a whole generation.
It basically created mass nicotine dependence. Then, the 50s saw the first real links to cancer, followed by the big Surgeon General's report in 64 and all the efforts since. Ad bans on TV, smokeout days, media campaigns, nicotine patches, and gum. Huge taxes.
And the filters. Interesting and kind of horrifying that some early filters apparently used asbestos.
Yeah, shows how little was understood then. The lecture also touched on how smoking rates vary a lot globally, different cultural norms.
And that statistic, smoking. Single greatest cause of preventable death. The analogy, the daily Boeing 747 crashes, that really hits home. The sheer scale of it.
It's a powerful way to illustrate the numbers, isn't it? Just staggering. And beyond lung cancer, the lecturer listed cardiovascular disease, other cancers, bronchitis, emphysema, just a whole range of serious health problems. Overall health is just lower in smokers.
And it's not just physical, right? Psychological factors too. Adolescence again, coping with stress or depression.
Definitely. Psychology plays a big part in starting and staying addicted. Right. The lecture also talked about how smokers and non-smokers see things differently, like how addictive it is, whether it helps with weight, if it's cool.
Okay, then it got into the brain science. The neurobiology of nicotine addiction. Sounded complex.
It boils down to these things called nicotinic acetylcholine receptors in the brain. Nicotine fits into these receptors, especially one called alpha-4 beta-2, like a key in a lock. This triggers a release of dopamine, the feel-good chemical, in the brain's reward system. That dopamine hit creates pleasure, reinforces the behavior, makes it incredibly addictive. The experiments shown with radioactive nicotine really illustrated how fast and completely nicotine floods those brain receptors after just a few puffs.
So what do we do about it? Prevention and cessation strategies. Prevention seems like the best bet long term.
Oh, absolutely. Stopping people from starting in the first place has the biggest impact. The lecture talked about changing social views, making smoking seem undesirable, using media effectively, and behavioral inoculation programs starting really young, in kindergarten even, teaching kids refusal skills, using positive role models like the Shawn Mendes example instead of the old cigarette ads. For people who already smoke, quitting cessation gives immediate benefits that add up hugely over time if they stick with it.
What about things like the graphic warning labels on packs and plain packaging? Do they work?
The lecture suggested the evidence is a bit mixed on exactly how much they make people quit. But the goal is definitely to make smoking less appealing, hammer home the health risks, and reduce that brand loyalty, especially for young people.
And then NRTs, nicotine replacement therapies, patches, gum, sprays, and e-cigarettes. The idea is getting nicotine without the burning tobacco, right? Reduce the harm.
Precisely. You deliver nicotine more safely, manage the addiction, and hopefully taper off without all the thousands of toxins from cigarette smoke. E-cigarettes got a lot of focus. Their history, how they work, battery, liquid, usually with propylene glycol, which is in lots of things, but raise questions about inhaling it.
And there was debate about regulating them in Canada initially. The lecture mentioned pros and cons.
Right. Potential pros, maybe safer than cigarettes for current smokers, less secondhand smoke, maybe cheaper. Users can control nicotine levels. But big cons, too. We don't know the long-term effects. Huge worry about youth uptake kids who never smoked cigarettes starting vaping, the appealing flavors clearly targeting youth. That's a major problem. And those recent Health Canada warnings about vaping-related lung illness are serious. The cases in the U.S. and Canada often linked to high nicotine frequent use and young users. The lecture even outlined the diagnostic criteria.
It also mentioned varenicline Chempix and some initial safety worries.
Yeah, varenicline. It's an example of why post-market safety monitoring is crucial. There were early concerns about possible links to psychiatric side effects, which led to updated prescribing guidelines to make sure it's used carefully.
And CBT came up again. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a really effective tool for quitting smoking, too.
Yes, CBT is powerful for smoking cessation. It gives people practical strategies to change their thought patterns and behaviors related to smoking, helps them cope with cravings.
Finally, that graph comparing NRTs. It showed nicotine patches giving the most steady nicotine level, kind of like smoking a cigarette over time.
Exactly. The patch delivers nicotine more slowly and consistently through the skin. This mimics the smoker's experience better than, say, gum or spray, which give quicker hits. And that steady level helps manage cravings and withdrawal throughout the day more effectively. Oh, and the cost comparison showed NRTs can actually end up being cheaper than buying cigarettes continuously.
Okay, last major topic, eating disorders. Important point right off the bat. Affects men and women.
Crucial point. We need to ditch the stereotype that it's only a women's issue. Men struggle significantly, too. The lecture pointed to drivers like unrealistic beauty standards in our culture, the intense pressure around weight loss and exercise, media influence comparing old pinups to today's super thin ideals. It acknowledged that while maybe adults can be more critical, teenagers are especially vulnerable to these messages.
That anecdote about Joaquin Phoenix losing weight for the Joker movie. How easily that controlled process could tip into something disordered. That was really illustrative.
It really was. Shows how even planned weight loss can morph into an unhealthy obsession. The lecture also shared some prevalence data for Canada, indicating rates seem to be increasing, which is concerning.
And common behaviors, diet pills, restricting food, laxative abuse, smoking to suppress appetite, self-induced vomiting. Then it focused on anorexia and bulimia. Anorexia as obsessive self-starvation.
Right. Anorexia nervosa involves an intense fear of gaining weight, a distorted body image, seeing yourself as overweight even when dangerously thin and severely limiting food intake. Risk factors mentioned included genetics, maybe an overactive stress response system, the HPA axis, trouble reading social cues around eating, being resistant to changing behaviors. The physical consequences are severe: low blood pressure, heart rhythm problems, high stress reactivity, high cortisol, plus cognitive issues like depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, and that distorted body image.
And bulimia nervosa is different, that cycle of binge eating than purging.
Exactly. Bulimia involves recurrent episodes of eating a very large amount of food quickly, feeling out of control, that's the binge, followed by compensatory behaviors to prevent weight gain, like vomiting, using laxatives, excessive exercise, or fasting. Key point, people with bulimia might be normal weight or even overweight, so it's not always obvious. Stress is often a trigger for binges, and denial can be a big barrier to getting help. The lecture was clear. Normal eating doesn't involve purging. The best treatment usually combines medication, often antidepressants for underlying issues, and CBT to build healthier coping skills and eating patterns.
Wow, that was a really thorough look at these health-compromising behaviors. It's just amazing how complex it all is. The biology, the psychology, the social factors all tangled together.
It really is. And what's quite revealing is seeing those common threads, you know, shared characteristics across different behaviors, and how society's pressures and individual vulnerabilities kind of intersect to create these challenges.
Yeah, this deep dive definitely gave me a lot to chew on. You know, thinking about all those forces, psychological, social, story, it makes you wonder, how can we actually do better? As individuals, as a society, how can we support people better in making healthier choices, overcoming these really ingrained patterns?
That's the big question, isn't it? It really pushes you to think further. Given everything we're learning, what are the best ways forward for prevention, for catching things early, for making sure effective, evidence-based help is actually available and accessible to everyone who needs it?
We've really only skimmed the surface here today. If any of this sparked your interest or if something resonated with your own experiences, we definitely encourage you to explore more. There are so many great resources out there, from local support groups to more research on public health strategies. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.